From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a talk with actor Matthew Modine, the star of Birdie, Full Metal Jacket, Married to the Mob, and Grey's Anatomy. Also, anthropologist Richard Nelson tells us about a place humans still haven't gotten to, the island he explored in the Pacific Northwest. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews a new reissue by the Gene Krupa Orchestra. It's called Uptown, and it features trumpeter Roy Eldridge and singer Anita O'Day. And book critic John Leonard reviews Mordecai Richler's new novel, Solomon Gursky Was Here. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Gorbachev said today that he does not rule out seizing direct control of the government in the rebellious Baltic Republic of Lithuania. Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
When the Soviet parliament created the new office of president last month and elected Mikhail Gorbachev to that position, it gave him a power called presidential rule. It is this power by decree that Gorbachev has suggested he might use, but only as an extreme measure, he said today, if the situation in Lithuania develops into a civil conflict. Over the last week, Gorbachev's rhetoric in the struggle over Lithuanian independence has become increasingly tougher. Today, Lithuania's president sent a telegram to Gorbachev, appealing to him not to make the wrong moves in the conflict. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The leader of Poland's Solidarity Party was quoted today as saying that he will run for president in the next elections. The state-owned news agency says that Lech Walesa will seek to replace General Wojciech Jaruzelski. Jaruzelski's current term as president goes until 1995, but there's widespread belief in Poland that elections will be moved up as part of an overhaul of the Polish constitution. Walesa was not immediately available for comment. The African National Congress has named its delegation for the first official meeting next month with the South African government. In a statement issued after consultations with Nelson Mandela at a secret location in Zambia, the organization's national executive denied that there was any division within the ANC's leadership. It also called on Pretoria to do more to bring an end to the violence in Natal, where 7 people were killed today in an ambush. The BBC's Mike Wooldridge has this report.
The National Executive met Mr. Mandela to assess the latest developments in South Africa, and it makes it clear in its statement how much importance it places on the talks about talks with the government, which were postponed because of the shooting of demonstrators in Sebokeng and will now take place in Cape Town in the first week of May. To achieve speedy movement towards the abolition of apartheid, the statement says, it's vital that the meeting leads to the removal of the obstacles to full negotiations. Principal among these, according to the ANC, are the release of all political prisoners and the lifting of the state of emergency. On Natal, the NEC accuses the police of leading, arming and protecting murderous vigilante groups and calls on the government to ensure that this campaign of terror, as it puts it, is brought to an end.
The BBC's Mike Wooldridge in Johannesburg. The chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization is calling for a special Arab summit conference to discuss Middle East issues before the superpower summit is held at the end of May. Speaking today in Tunisia, Yasser Arafat said that the Arab conference would deal with challenges facing the Arab world. Arafat specifically mentioned the immigration of Soviet Jews to Israel and perceived Israeli threats against Iraq. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones closed at 2,731. This is NPR. The space shuttle mission to lift a giant telescope into orbit was called off today, minutes before liftoff. NASA officials say that a fault in the shuttle's hydraulic steering system could delay the mission for at least a week and possibly two. The shuttle Discovery was to have taken off this morning with a crew of 5 astronauts and the telescope, which astronomers believe will revolutionize knowledge about the universe. Federal safety officials today blamed the airline, the manufacturer, and a government agency for the February 1989 accident on United Flight 811 over Hawaii. NPR's Celeste Wesson reports.
The cargo door of the Boeing 747 ripped off while the plane was 22,000 feet above the Pacific and tore a 10-by-15-foot hole in the fuselage. 9 passengers were sucked out of the plane to their deaths. The others returned safely to Honolulu. Today, the National Transportation Safety Board said it has concluded that United Airlines did not inspect the cargo door properly after its electrical system broke and it had to be closed manually. The safety board also said the door lock system was badly designed, it was vulnerable to wear and tear, and it may indicate the door is locked when it's not. The safety board also found Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration at fault for not ordering corrective measures after another cargo door failed on a Pan Am 747 2 years earlier. The FAA is now expected to order that Boeing 747 cargo doors be fitted with an additional warning system. I'm Celeste Wesson in Los Angeles.
Seven U.S. airspaces have been listed as critically deficient by an international airline pilots group. The group says it put the seven locations on its pilot advisory Black Star list because of the changes in the federal rules on the allowable distances between aircraft. The rating went to the terminal control areas over airports in Charlotte, North Carolina, Cleveland, Dallas-Fort Worth, Los Angeles, Memphis, Philadelphia, and Phoenix. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of Matthew Modine's first leading roles was in the 1984 film Birdie. He played an introverted, emotionally fragile young man who identifies with birds and longs to fly. You might have thought he was destined for a career of sensitive roles, but you would have been wrong. In Stanley Kubrick's Vietnam movie Full Metal Jacket, Modine was the cynical private joker. In Mrs. Sofel, he was cast as Mel Gibson's younger brother. And in Married to the Mob, he showed his gift for romantic comedy. In Modine's latest film, Gross Anatomy, he played a cocky first-year med student. Gross Anatomy was part drama, but also allowed Modine to use his comedic talents. The first comedy I saw him in was Married to the Mob. I asked him if he was anxious to try comedy.
Married to the Mob, just funnily enough, was something I wasn't interested in doing at all, and Jonathan Demme and Michelle Pfeiffer practically tied me up and slapped me till I did it. And I mean, I'm very happy I did it because, first of all, it was a great deal of fun, and Jonathan and both Michelle are really, I mean, I know it sounds silly to say it, but they're really wonderful people.
How come you were reluctant to do Married to the Mob and Demme and Michelle Pfeiffer had to work so hard to convince you?
I'd worked with Stanley Kubrick in London for about a year and a half, and I came straight back and went to work with Alan Pakula on a film called Orphans with Albert Finney and Kevin Anderson. And I think just emotionally, I was a little bit played out because London was a long trip, and Stanley Kubrick just demanded so much from his actors, and it seemed so light and frivolous that it wasn't something that seemed important, or I just didn't feel it was for me. I wasn't interested in doing that kind of movie. And it was really just out of their enthusiasm for me to do the role that I finally committed to it.
I thought you were really terrific in that comedy, and there was this really great interplay all the time between what you were saying and what your face was revealing, and it was the kind of role where you were making up characters as you went along. I mean, the character is always in another pose, and so he's always having to make things up as he goes along. And you could always, like, see in your eyes the character thinking, well, what am I going to tell her now? Who am I going to be now?
Am I going to get away with it this time?
Exactly. Did you have much experience doing comedy when you did that? And did you kind of intellectually think through how you were going to reveal certain things with your eyes and your facial gestures?
Yeah, well, certainly Jonathan Demme was a huge help. I mean, he's a really animated, happy person, an optimist, you know, who he'd send me actual police reports following the movements of the mafia. So he wanted, I mean, certainly, you know, for the film to be funny and stuff, but he wanted it to be based on, you know, that when I say I want to get Tony the Tiger Russo, that I really want to get him, and I really want to, you know, put him in jail because, you know, the mafia is an evil thing, and they shouldn't be allowed to get away with the things that they, you know, that he was sending me.
Matthew Modine is my guest. You came to New York when you were 18, is that right?
That's right.
And from Utah?
Uh-huh.
Did you have any idea what kind of actor you wanted to be when you got to New York?
Well, the only experience that I had was working in the theater, and I knew that Los Angeles wasn't the sort of place to go to get that kind of experience. And one of the things I found that whenever I'd met somebody from the East, they always seemed to be much more intelligent than the people that I'd met from where I'd grown up. And I found that after I'd lived here for a while, it wasn't that they were more intelligent than me. They just knew different things, you know. And They didn't know how to fix a car. They didn't know how to fix a toaster. It wasn't that they were more intelligent. They just knew and understood different things.
When you first started going to auditions in New York, was it ever held against you that you weren't a native New Yorker? And were you ever typecast because you were from Utah?
Nah, I studied with a really wonderful woman, Stella Adler, when I came here. And, I mean, she sort of had a prejudice against everyone that was in the classroom, because she studied with Stanislavski and did plays by some of the most important playwrights of the 20th century, Chekhov and Ibsen and Tennessee Williams and O'Neill. And I mean, she said, I mean, how can I teach you people anything? You grew up watching Gilligan's Island and Lost in Space,
Well, did you feel that way about yourself?
Well, yeah, I agreed with her. It's really frustrating. And it's one of the things that that Christine Lottie, who's in Gross Anatomy, and I talked about was this student-mentor relationship. And that, when you're in a situation where you have a teacher like that who's really a pain in the rear and demands so much of you that you don't understand why they're being so hard on you and why they're being so difficult, and what it is that they just want the best from you, and it's not till you get some distance between you and that teacher that you start to understand the things that they were teaching you and appreciate their hard work.
When you first started going to auditions in New York, were you very nervous at auditions? Did you have a hard time giving a good performance at first, as many actors do?
About as nervous as I am talking to you right now on the radio. it's awful, the whole auditioning process, and you can become very callous and cynical and bitter by the process. And I always like to give credit to this woman, Margie Simkin, who I got my first film with, John Sayles.
This was Baby, It's You.
Baby, It's You, that's right. And because when I came in and sat down and read for her, she said, that was great, now try it this way. And it was the first time that a casting director had taken some time and just to ask for something more instead of just looking at you. And she actually worked with me and spent some time and said, that's great, I'd like you to come back tomorrow and meet the director. And I wish that more of the casting directors would have been like that, but it's probably why Margie Simkin is as successful as that she is,
Well, the part that you had in Baby, It's You is you played a young man who dates Rosanna Arquette in the college sequences in the second part of the movie.
That's right.
So it wasn't a very large part. Did you feel like you had to do everything you possibly could to be noticed in this film so that you can make the most of your debut performance? It would be really tempting to almost give too much in a performance the first time because you're so anxious for people to notice you.
I just was afraid that I wouldn't, hold up my end. I wasn't trying to showcase myself or say, hey, look at me. I just wanted to not disappoint anyone, because I really like John Sayles. I think he's a wonderful director, and I just didn't want to make one false move or one false word. I labored over it for, weeks.
Well, what kind of preparation could you do for the part? You take Rosanna Arquette on a date, you meet her in the dorm room.
Yeah, I read, I think, every book that Desmond Morris wrote about physical posturing, body language and listening to all the music from the 60s. And I just didn't want to make a mistake. And of course, when I got there, John Sayles, it was all so easy, and Rosanna Arquette is a really, talented actress. And, I mean, it all became so, so simple,
So do you still do things like that? Read Desmond Morris books? He wrote The Naked Ape, about human behavior. Do you still read
man
stuff
watching.
Like that?
Yeah. I find it really valuable. I think that every movie that I do, I mean, it's one of the wonderful things about my job is that the places that it takes you, and with Gross Anatomy, I didn't know anything about the medical profession, and I just did a film called Memphis Belle with Michael Caton Jones, who directed Scandal, and I learned about the Second World War and about the B-17s that flew into Europe on these daylight bombing missions, and I learned how to fly a B-17, which is probably, anybody who's listening that's a pilot, would give their left finger to be able to fly one. It's just there's only about a dozen of them in the world that fly. And I mean, there I was for about 8 hours flying a B-17 around London, you know, a couple thousand feet off the ground. It was fantastic. So, I mean, the field that I'm in, it's so great because, I mean, I get to learn so much, and I get to talk to people like you and have to explain, and in that explanation, I get to understand myself a little bit more and why I make decisions to do things. And it's a really wonderful learning process. And I mean, the best thing is, of course, to be able to share that with people that go and sit down in a theater in a dark room and watch a movie, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's talk more about movies, but we have to take a short break first. My guest is Matthew Modine, and he stars in the film Gross Anatomy, in which he plays a first-year medical student. He's also starred in the films Birdie, Full Metal Jacket, and Married to the Mob. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Matthew Modine is my guest. You starred in the 1984 film Birdie, in which you played a very sensitive, emotionally withdrawn, emotionally fragile young man whose greatest emotional connection is to birds, and he's someone who really wants to fly. This character is really very allegorical in a way. How do you play a character like that without it seeming to be absurdly literal? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I suppose I have to give credit to William Wharton for writing such a wonderful book. I mean, he articulated with his words so much of the posturing and mental attitude that I had in the film. So,
well, you know, you were talking about the body language before in studying body language, and Birdie was a movie where you really, I think, drew on whatever you knew about body language, because you really communicated that sense of being withdrawn yet wanting to take physical flight.
Yeah, thank you. It's funny because it's so hard to talk about. I just came, as I say, back from London, and I heard one of these radio interviews with Peter Sellers, and he was so articulate and so funny, and I don't know how he did it, you know, to be able to talk about things that seem so
intuitive,
and elusive to yourself. That, you know, I mean, sometimes I'm almost afraid to try to figure it out what or how I do something, in the fear that it, you know, will vanish and disappear. I know that I started to talk about Desmond Morris and the kind of preparation that I've done in the past, and I find that it. Nothing ever works twice. I find myself, I'm not able to go back to some book for reference and say, oh yeah, that's what I need here. It's always a constant search to try to find something else to fill myself up and find new information, because the old stuff never satisfies, it never helps. And perhaps that's why the movies are always so different. That, I mean, there's nothing satisfying or nothing there in repetition of doing a role that's similar to another one.
I want to ask you about working with Nicolas Cage, who plays your very extroverted buddy in Birdie. He seems like a very extroverted actor in a way, and I would guess that you both prepare kind of differently for films, though I don't really know.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if you did, and if you did prepare differently, if those different styles of acting helped or clashed during the making of the movie?
They didn't clash. I mean, Nicholas kept the bandages on for the entire, you know, second half of the film, and you know,
these were bandages on his face because he's injured in the war, and a lot of the movies told in flashback.
Thank you. And had he had because his face had been hit by a you know, some shrapnel, he decided he had these two baby teeth that he had taken out, because he knew that they had to come out, and he thought, well, this is as good a time as any to have them taken out, because they can work for the film. And
By keeping him in pain, so he has real facial pain.
Yeah, and that if you ever got close enough with the camera, you'd see that he was missing two teeth and go, like, my God, you know, the guy had two teeth knocked out of his mouth. And this has actually become a real bone of contention with myself in this preparation of an actor, that preparation is something that seems so personal and something that should be kept to yourself. And I mean, otherwise you're showing your tricks. You know, I don't want to know why Jack Nicholson is Jack Nicholson. I don't want to know the kind of things that he has to do, because I don't want to destroy the illusion that he creates, you know.
Mm-hmm, But you're saying, too, here, that you don't think as an actor that you have to, get teeth pulled or suffer physical things similar to the character that you're playing in order to do a good performance.
It just makes me angry to think that people believe now that an actor has to experience some kind of personal suffering to do a job as an actor. I mean, I think I learned this lesson when I was doing Birdie, that when we did the hospital sequence, we were filming at a hospital in San Jose, California, and I thought, well, you know, I've got the hospital robes on, my head is shaved, I'll go out and sit with some of the mentally disturbed or mentally retarded people, and I sat down with them, and I felt like I was insulting them so deeply, and they knew that I wasn't somebody from their community, and I wasn't retarded somehow or mentally disturbed, and I felt like I was very condescending and insulting to them, you know, because of their condition, and that I was making fun of it. And in the end, I mean, when I go home at night, I go home, and to say to as an actor that you know, you you can prepare and prepare and prepare, but you're never going to be able to really live the kind of life that someone like Birdie was experiencing. It's insulting to every Vietnam veteran to say that, you know, I spent 6 weeks with some guy who trained me to act like a Vietnam soldier, and now I know what it's like, and I'm going to interpret it. And I just think that it's disrespectful to any, you know, any of those people that you know, that they're trying to represent, that have gone through some kind of hardship, that they'll never be able to experience the kind of hardship that you're an actor and that you're representing them, and you know, I think I've said enough.
I understand what you mean. Mm. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is actor Matthew Modine, and he stars in the film Gross Anatomy. He's also starred in Birdie, Full Metal Jacket, and Married to the Mob, among other films. I'm interested in your background. You grew up in Utah. I know your father managed a drive-in or a chain of drive-ins, I wasn't sure which.
It was a chain of drive-ins.
Mm-hmm. So were these drive-ins that showed mostly what we now think of as drive-in films, exploitation films, or did they show a little bit of everything? I know when I was growing up, I saw Diary of Anne Frank at a drive-in.
Yeah.
They used to show everything at drive-ins.
Yeah, occasionally, you know, you get a Catch-22 or a Midnight Cowboy, but usually, yeah, it was the swinging stewardesses, or, you know, the beach blanket, something or other. And It was a great way to grow up, because I saw so much of Utah because we moved every couple of years, and it's one of the things that frightens me about the future of this country and certainly the world and the way that it's being developed, was that I thought my father was someone who fixed drive-ins for a living, that he was a rehabilitator of drive-ins because they were always so dilapidated and run down, and we'd come in, and I have four brothers and two sisters, and he put us all to work, you know, fixing the snack bar and pulling weeds and making the lawns, you know, manicuring the place. And being the youngest, I was the one that was in charge of picking up all the garbage and cigarette butts off the drive-in, you know, floor. And then we'd move after a couple of years, and we'd have to go through the same process and the difficulty of being the new kid on the block and, you know, punching your way through a new school. And as I got older, I'd want to go back and see friends that I'd made, you know, from other schools and try to go back in time. And my father always tried to discourage me because, being older, he knows that you get replaced and that there's not going to be the same kind of past that you remember.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the most shocking things to find out was that when I'd go back and, like, see where I'd buried my dog or where something had happened, and, like, want to look at the house that I'd lived in for a couple of years, that it was all gone.
So when you were growing up, did you see most movies from behind the windshield, or were you in the snack bar serving food?
No, I had, you know, turned the speakers down. And so besides getting, watching the movies, I got my sex education from the back rows of the drive-in, speaking in the back windows of cars, yeah.
Oh, that's great. So where else did you watch movies? Did you go to theaters at all?
Yeah, actually, the first theater that we had when we moved to Utah was a proper, legitimate theater that had been converted into a movie theater. It was called the Lyric, and now it's called the Mormon Playhouse Theater in I think on State Street in Utah. And behind the movie screen, there were, you know, a dozen backdrops from legitimate theater that had been done in this very, very old theater. And they had dressing rooms off the side with all these pictures of I mean, it would be fun to go back and see it now, because they just were pictures of very strange people to me then. But, you know, all these 8x10 glossies of actors from all over the country or all over the world that had visited this theater in Salt Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just spent so much time in that theater, you know, waiting for my father to come home from work. And theaters are strange, spirit-filled places, you know, that smell of old cigarettes and coffee. And it was a very romantic childhood I had.
Growing up in Utah, it's a very morally and politically conservative state. Were you comfortable in that environment, or did you rebel against it?
I think I was probably too young to rebel. I mean, I know that I know all my brothers did completely rebel against the staid nature of that conservative, you know, plus because they're Mormons, that it was a very old-fashioned place, and trying to break loose and punch holes in that conservative atmosphere. There was a lot of drug taking, and you know, my brothers all went through the 60s and were all a part of that. And being the youngest, I got to watch them and not have to go through the things that they went through.
Mm-hmm. Did you dream of other places?
Yeah, and I had an uncle that lived in Beverly Hills, and I think that's when I first started lying about being an actor.
Wait. Back up. You started lying about being an actor?
Yeah, because my father was a drive-in theater manager. It's a very high-profile job for, you know, young kids, because that seems, you know, it's show business. And he'd give me little pieces of film to bring and show during the winter when we couldn't go to recess. So it made me very popular, bringing these, you know, Peter Pan or something to show to the fifth grade class. And my uncle lived in Beverly Hills, so they already thought that I was part of show business. And if I went, if my uncle was kind enough to invite me to stay with him for the summer, I would go to Beverly Hills and, you know, play on the beach and stuff. But I'd tell everybody there that I was going, because of course I was going to Los Angeles and Beverly Hills to become a movie star. You know, that I was going to work on this movie or that movie, and you know, they believed me.
Well, Matthew Modine, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thanks.
It's very nice to talk to you.
Matthew Modine starred in the films Gross Anatomy, Full Metal Jacket, Birdie, and Married to the Mob. He has a new film coming out later this year called The Memphis Belle. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, one of America's most celebrated male dancers, Edward Villella. He made his career with the New York City Ballet under George Balanchine and is now founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. That's the Gene Krupa Orchestra, as recorded in 1941. It's part of a new reissue of Krupa's big band recordings from the early 40s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review coming up on Fresh Air. Anthropologist Richard Nelson lives near an island somewhere in the Pacific Northwest, but he's not telling where it is. It's an island with no people, but an abundance of wildlife. Nelson's devoted the last few years to exploring and writing about the island. He'll tell us how his explorations have been influenced by the Native Americans he's lived with and studied. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new novel by the Canadian writer Mordecai Richler, the author of The Apprenticeship of Duty Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is in Toronto, where he's met today with Canadian Prime Minister Mulroney. This evening, the two are attending the Toronto Blue Jays home opener. The two leaders discussed a range of issues during their meeting today, and according to the Prime Minister, they agreed to start talks toward an acid rain treaty this summer. Richard Reynolds reports from Toronto.
A short press conference followed the 90-minute meeting between the two leaders. President Bush said that he and Mulroney saw eye to eye on East-West issues, particularly the way the U.S. is dealing with the Soviet Union on Lithuania and arms control. The two also discussed the free trade treaty between the two nations, which has now been in place for 15 months. Both leaders indicated they felt the trade pact had been a success. Mulroney also said that negotiations would begin this summer on a different sort of treaty, this one to control pollution, specifically acid rain. Bush agreed last year that in principle such a treaty was a good idea. The Canadians want an agreement which will mandate reductions in acid rain-causing emissions. Mulroney has been criticized for the plan in Canada. Canadian environmentalists say the treaty could derail clean air legislation currently making its way through the U.S. Congress. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
In Washington, the State Department has declined to respond to a suggestion that thousands of Contra rebels resettle inside the United States rather than in Nicaragua. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Contra leaders and representatives of President-elect Violeta Chamorro said the rebels have agreed to sign a ceasefire pact with the current Nicaraguan government. They also said they will order their troops to enter special security zones for eventual demobilization. However, one Contra leader, Aristides Sanchez, said he would urge the State Department to allow some 20,000 fighters and their families now in Honduras to move to the United States. When questioned today on the idea, the State Department's Margaret Tutwiler offered this response.
The United States government supports the voluntary repatriation and reintegration of resistance members into Nicaragua under secure and democratic conditions.
One U.S. official amplified that remark, saying the future of the Nicaraguan resistance is inside Nicaragua, not the United States. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In Poland, the shipyard where the Solidarity labor movement was founded will be transferred from state ownership to private ownership. The manager of the shipyard at Gdansk says that shares will be sold to employees and the public. Shipyard workers will be able to buy 20% of the shares at half the offering price before the end of 1990 and at half the market price after that. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 9 points to close at 2731.08 on volume of some 136 million shares. Trading was moderate as declining issues led advances. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. That's drummer Gene Krupa on his most famous performance, Benny Goodman's Sing, Sing, Sing. It was recorded in 1937, a year before Krupa left Goodman to start the first of his own bands. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that because most people remember Gene Krupa for his ruthless tom-tom beating with Goodman, they tend to underrate him as a drummer and overlook him as a band leader. Kevin reviews a reissue of Krupa recordings from the early 1940s.
Gene Krupa gets a bum rap these days. Musicologist Gunther Schuller, in his book The Swing Era, uses adjectives like overbearing, offensive, and monotonous to describe Krupa's drumming. A couple of months ago, an article ran in Musician magazine that puffed up Buddy Rich's reputation at Krupa's expense. It told how Rich could literally play Krupa's solos with one hand. Admittedly, Flashmaster Rich had better chops, but Krupa knew the advantages of simplicity. It gave him one thing every jazz musician should have, a readily identifiable style. As for his reputation as a pounder, listen to how discreetly he drives the band after his solo intro on the 1941 recording Bolero at the Savoy. In the 1930s, Gene Krupa was a hero. A decade later, people thought he was old-fashioned. Part of the reason is that he focused more on tom-toms and snare drum than on his ride cymbals. The bebop drummers who came up in the 1940s did the opposite. But in retrospect, Krupa's style is that much more distinctive because he went against the grain. That slice, you can hear what rock drummers got from Krupa, though most jazz drummers reveal his influence when they work out on tom-toms. These recordings are from a new reissue on Columbia called Uptown, which is credited to Roy Eldridge with the Gene Krupa Orchestra featuring Anita O'Day. That ungainly billing does explain what made the band so good. Trumpeter Eldridge was its instrumental star and part-time singer. He was also one of the first black musicians featured with an otherwise all-white band. Back then, Anita O'Day was one of the best singers in jazz, with a light, vibrato-less voice and strong sense of rhythm.
If you want to pitch a ball, and you can't afford a hall, all you've got to call is, let me off uptown.
Anita, oh Anita, say, I feel something.
What you feel, Roy? The heat?
No, it must be that uptown rhythm. I feel like blowing.
Well, blow, Roy, blow.
Eldridge and O'Day had good musical rapport, but they squabbled off stage, which is one reason this combination didn't last very long. Roy Eldridge had joined Krupa early in 1941. Anita O'Day left at the end of 42. 1942 was also the year the wartime propaganda machine geared up. The swing bands did their part, Krupa's with more wit than most. On the intro to the Air Force tribute, Keep 'Em Flying, his trombones made like dive bombers. But another of Krupa's patriotic numbers was more interesting from a sociological standpoint.
In the distance I heard a sound, the sound of marching men. I turned my head to view the drum corps. The move, see them marching in the groove. Uncle Sam is mighty proud of Harlem on parade. With a smile they all perform in a full drape uniform. Everybody's here to cheer for Harlem on parade. When you hear the bugle blow, that's the time you're bound to know that the man behind the horn is as handy with the gun when there's fighting to be done. Every heart within the crowd beats it out with head unbowed. Uncle Sam is mighty proud of Harlem on parade.
As one social critic recently pointed out, Harlem on Parade must be the only mainstream song that celebrates an army of gun-toting African-Americans marching through New York. The drummer's band helped fight the good fight for racial equality. In 1943, Krupa disbanded after a dubious marijuana bust. That arrest became the dramatic center of the wonderfully silly 1959 film, The Gene Krupa Story. Check it out next time it's on TV. But while you're laughing at the movie or at the novelty tunes his band recorded, don't forget, Gene Krupa was one serious musician.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed the Columbia reissue of Gene Krupa's album Uptown. This is Fresh Air. Anthropologist Richard Nelson spent years in the North living with and studying among Native Americans, but he spent the last few years exploring an island near his home in the Pacific Northwest. His book, The Island Within, is an account of his exploration. As he describes it, the island is big and mountainous, covered with forest and swamp-like meadows. Deer, mink, and brown bears are among the inhabitants. No people live on the island, but during World War II it was a military station, and rotted Quonset huts are the only reminder that other people were once there. In the preface to The Island Within, Nelson writes, "As time went by, I realized that the particular place I'd chosen was less important than the fact that I'd chosen a place and focused my life around it." I asked him how long it took him to realize that.
Oh, it took me quite a while. You know, after I'd been around the island for, a couple of years, I suddenly realized that I could think about this place as something special and maybe the most beautiful and wonderful place in the world. But then I realized that wasn't true at all, that every place in the world is as special as every other place. And what makes this one special for me is the relationship that I have to it, that it's my home. And I think it's a real important, it was a really important insight for me to recognize that any of us can have the same relationship to the place where we live. We just need to try to be there attentively and paying attention and loving the place.
Was this a particularly important realization for you because you'd spent so much time living in other people's homes and other people's territories as an anthropologist?
Oh, definitely. You know, you're in someone else's culture and in someone else's community. You never feel that you really belong there. You may be welcome there, and people are very kind to you. But I think it develops in you a deep yearning to have a home and to know that you belong there and to know that it's your place on earth. Especially because, for example, having lived with Native American people, they are so deeply rooted in their home, going back generation upon generation upon generation, living always in the presence of their ancestors and drawing on the knowledge of those ancestors. You begin to realize that we in Western culture have lost this deep sense of rootedness, not irretrievably. Of course, what drives me, I think, right now is a sense that we can regain this belonging and this home.
You talk about establishing a moral contract with the world. Elaborate on that.
Well, I learned about living in a sort of a moral, spiritual relationship to nature from elders of the Koyukon Athabascan Indians, whom I lived among for a couple of years. And for those people, everything in the natural world has a spirit, and everything is conscious and aware, so that if you're standing next to a tree, it knows you're there. And if you mistreat an animal, it becomes offended by this. Well, I never knew if this was literally true. I never knew if the spirit was really in things. But there seemed to be a deeper wisdom in that a person should behave as if it is, whether you know or not. And I think it's something that can apply to any of us. So I've tried to follow the Koyukon people's way of respecting animals, just as one way out of many, and think that people could choose their own gestures of respect toward nature as a constant reminder of where their life comes from, and of the fragility of the earth and the need to treat the earth carefully.
Now, within this moral contract with the world, you hunt, and one of the animals you hunt is deer, and you're really in awe of deer. Is this a contradiction?
Well, I don't think so. I grew up in Wisconsin being opposed to hunting. I thought hunting was wrong and immoral. I learned how to hunt from Eskimo people in northern Alaska, and so it came to me as a way to make a living, not as a sport or recreation. And I found, especially living with Koyukon people, where this religious tradition is so intertwined with a hunting life, that there are ways of taking other lives and doing it with respect and humility. And I think each of us lives only at the behest of other lives. Even if we're vegetarians or whatever it is that we eat, it comes only from the earth, all of it. And so I think there's a special richness in being responsible for taking that life that gives you your own life.
Well, so how did you go about hunting deer, taking this into account?
Well, when I hunt, I try to be mindful that as Koyukon people would say, that the animal knows way more than you do, that you have to talk respectfully about it. If I'm going hunting, I don't say that's what I'm going to do. I just say I'm going to go out and look around. And then if I happen to get an animal, I always say thank you to the animal, and I always treat whatever parts of the animal I don't use carefully. I don't just throw things in the garbage. I take them back, like the bones, I always take back to the island and leave them there. Any parts that I don't use, I say, well, these are for the other animals. I should say that in doing these sorts of things, I'm not trying to imitate Native American people or to pretend that I am one. I'm trying to see if there's a universal wisdom here that applies to myself as a comfortably practicing member of my own Euro-American culture. If those principles can apply to me, then I feel, well, they can apply to any of us, to all of us, perhaps.
And what conclusion are you reaching?
Well, I guess what I think is that Native American people lived on the North American continent for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and did it in such a way that when the first Europeans arrived here, they mistakenly began calling it a wilderness. It was so pristine and so rich that it was hard for them to imagine anyone had ever lived here. And in thousands of years, I think that the Native American people developed an earthbound wisdom that is really, really so significant that we might do well to start trying to learn from it.
You write that in spite of all your contact with Native peoples that you've remained an agnostic.
Yes, I haven't tried to achieve some kind of orthodoxy in Native American beliefs. I just think that these principles are so wise and so profound and such good reminders to us of where our lives come from that they're worth following. You don't have to adopt some kind of a deep religious faith to do it. You just have to see that this is a wise way to live.
How do you make a living?
Well, such as it is, sometimes I teach, most recently at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I do little research projects on contracts. But when I was working on this book, which took years, I wrote full-time for 18 months, and I spent about 3 years on the island and worked from about 2,000 pages of journal material when I did the book. During most of that time, my partner, Nita, worked to support the research and the writing.
Ah, okay. In part of your book, you describe exploring Kluxa Mountain, which is on the island that you've been exploring, and during this time, your partner was away with her dying mother, dying of cancer. And I was wondering if you felt maybe that you were kind of out of balance emotionally at that point, seeking solitude and understanding the island while, you know, someone in your family was really ill.
It was a very difficult time. I was staying at home because our son was in school, and so Nita had to be with her mother, and I had to be home. It was kind of the way we divided the duties at that time.
I see.
But to be going out and having these adventures and these great times while other people were away amid such suffering was very difficult. But my time on the island ended up being just critical for me to try to come to grips with the death that was happening in our family. And I suppose in the long run, that was the most important thing that came for me out of this island experience, was a much better sense of what life and death meant for me personally.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried that with the writing of your book, The Island Within, that people will want to find this island that you consider so special?
Yes, that really concerns me. It seems to me that a lot of the nature and outdoor literature rests on a precarious balance between showing people where wonderful places are on the continent so people will care about keeping them in their wild state versus drawing crowds, such great crowds, to places that their specialness is destroyed. It's a balance that I have struggled profoundly with myself, and have chosen to preserve the anonymity of the place out of an ethical principle of respect toward it. Also, I think out of respect toward my readers. I think that everyone should have the same opportunity to discover this place as I discovered it and as many people discovered it before me. And so one thing I would really like to see is a consideration of this in the whole community of people who read and write nature literature, that we need to develop a way to care about places without necessarily destroying their anonymity.
Mm-hmm. So how have you tried to preserve the anonymity of the island?
Well, the main way I've done it is by not talking about where it is, and by using place names that are not found on maps.
Mm-hmm.
Let's leave it at that.
Okay. Richard Nelson, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Richard Nelson is the author of The Island Within. It's published by North Point Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
There's some trouble in the Xinjiang province of China. Reportedly, some people there have been killed. The province is on China's western frontier, right along the border with the Soviet Union. The population, largely Muslim there, and the Chinese authorities are concerned about a separatist movement. The National Park Service says it will not for now move the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse on North Carolina's Outer Banks. The tower is threatened by erosion, and there was a plan to move the lighthouse about a half mile inland to keep it away from the ocean on a specially built railroad. Also, a farewell to John Henry Falk, a former radio commentator who was blacklisted back in the 50s. John Henry Falk has died.
That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The movies The Apprenticeship of Judy Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now were based on novels by the Canadian writer Mordecai Richler. Richler has a new novel called Solomon Gursky Was Here. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Mordecai Richler has written such a rich, textured, hilarious, obsessive, symbol-clashing, history-haunted, myth-begotten Aurora Borealis of a book that I can't do more here than chase after a few of its black ravens and gnaw on its caribou bones. Savage Fun is made of Jewish-Canadian parvenus, Scots-Irish power brokers, English anti-Semites, even Eskimos. This fun is made in a pastiche of styles, from Old Testament Looney Tunes to Victorian pornography to Levi Strauss creation myths to Private Eye whodunits to Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, and radio soaps. But Richler's more imperial in his ambition. He also takes on world history and original sin. Think of his novel, if you're stuck on Latin America, as 150 years of Jewish-Canadian solitude. though it seems to me to derive as much from Gimple the Fool as from Garcia Marquez. Before there was magical realism, there was the Kabbalah, the Jewish book of mysticism. Anyway, Solomon Gursky is a dream of the earthly paradise gone wrong, of a world in which the just kingdom is nowhere to be found, and the Flying Dutchman is a wandering Jew. We meet two Gurskys in particular. Ephraim, who left Russian Jewish Minsk for the London of Charles Dickens, and thence to the polar seas of Canada, where, shaman and con man, he converted the Eskimos to the Covenant. And Solomon, Ephraim's favorite grandson, stolen by him as a child to sit on the shores of the Great Slave Lake and dream strange dreams. When Ephraim dies, a raven leads his grandchild out of the wilderness. Solomon's brothers will make lots of money in the bootleg liquor biz during Prohibition, because the Gurskys closely resemble the notorious Bronfman family, from whom, in Canada, all Seagrams flow. But Solomon disappears from Canada, into modern history. He bootlegs ideas. No matter what happens in modern history, from Mao's long march to the death of Marilyn Monroe to Watergate, Solomon seems to have been there, like Kilroy, or Woody Allen's Zelig, and so was a raven, that meddlesome and deceitful bird. Mostly we see these Gurskys from the point of view of Moses Berger, an alcoholic writer working on a biography of Solomon, based on journals, letters, and memoirs, in a delirium brought on by munching the liver of a polar bear. Moses is looking for a father. He hates the one he was born with, a poet who became a flack for the Gurskys. Everybody in this novel hates their father, or the fathers hate their sons. Oedipal rage is one of Richler's themes, along with cannibalism. If one Gursky father sinks his teeth in his son's hand, another Gursky son will eat his dead father like a drumstick. Besides Oedipus and cannibalism, Richler's also obsessed with the Northwest Passage, the quest for the mythical kingdom of Prester John, Jewish gangsters, radical history, and, of course, Canada. Not even Canada wanted the Jews. What's going on here? Solomon writes to Moses, "Look at it this way. The system was inspired, but it is man that is vile. It won't work. The Sermon on the Mount, the Manifesto. The world continues to pay a punishing toll for our Jewish dreamers." Like Jesus Christ, like Karl Marx, Solomon is one of those utopian dreamers. The dream is betrayed. It's a nightmare of ravens. It's also a wonderful novel.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Solomon Gursky Was Here by Mordecai Richler. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Roberta Shorrock and Allison Dufty. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the first male stars of American ballet, Edward Villella. He danced with the New York City Ballet under the guidance of choreographer George Balanchine. Now Villella's continuing the Balanchine tradition as artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. Also, we meet novelist Tom Robbins. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.